Here we.
Da-na-na. How does it go again?
It goes like this. He got some banjo in there. That's feeling good. Oh, geez. Do you hear that? Oh, so my soundboard started saying, like, I'm using a unauthorized, unpurchased version.
What a great way to start the show.
What an expose. I haven't actually paid for this. Truth be told, 5 minutes before this, I tried to buy it, but the Mac App Store was down, so... Take that, soundboard. Don't welcome to Shop Talk.
We're all about buying software, you guys. Yes, welcome to Shop Talk. We have a super awesome guest today, Jeff Way of Envato and NetTuts, NetToots, and
NetToots.
Is it NetToots or NetTuts?
It's NetTuts.
In my NetTuts.
We even have people in the company who call it NetToots, and we've established, like, at Envato, it is Touch. So it's PSD Touch, it's NetTuts. And we have some people in the company that are like, no, I like NetToots. And then they just go on calling it like that. It's insane. Yeah, it's nothing like related to a toot. Jar. It's a tut.
You know, some people are like, if you say a swear, you got to put a dollar in the jar. You got to have that.
Yeah, good. Like the douchebag jar.
Devil's advocate here, are you guys not in the business of distributing tutorials?
Yeah, but who wants
rather
to
than
it
like
a toot?
King Tuts?
no, it's totally short for tutorial would be toot, but who would ever call it toot? Just too many references there. Anyways, Net Touch sounds a lot better.
I'd agree.
But that's not all you do at Envato, right? You do work on that and other stuff. What do you want to tell us about what y'all do?
I really help out in lots of areas at the company. So for those unfamiliar, Envato, like, we have our educational side where we just teach you how to do lots of cool stuff. And then for people who really know what they're doing, we have these marketplaces where, for example, let's say you're really, really good at creating WordPress themes. You could go to like a marketplace called ThemeForest, and then you can just open up your own business there and sell it. And then we have guys that make like 50 grand a month. It's insane. So, yeah, I get to help out on both sides of the company there. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, that is cool. I often dream about it. I'm like, one of these days, I'm just going to, you know, some people are like, I'm just going to give up and travel around the world. I'm like, I'm going to give it up at all and start selling on ThemeForest.
You know what's amazing?
Like my travel around the world.
I think we all think that. And the truth is, and I think even like the top guys on that marketplace will tell you, you don't have to be a genius here. It's really the difference between the guys who make that much money and the guys who don't is that they just do it. That's all they do every week is they just keep knocking these out. So you get to this point where these guys have like 50 to 100 items for sale, and that's just this passive income that's coming in every single day. It's ridiculous how much these guys make.
Right. It's like the no magic approach. Like, of course, like whatever you do all day is what you get good at doing, you know, and it's not like some magic get rich quick scheme. Right. If you work hard, there'll be rewards. Right?
Absolutely. It's like the same thing with blogging. I remember, Chris, you said something like you want to shoot to the top of Google, dedicate your career and your life to a subject and it'll just naturally happen. And I agree with that so much. It's the same thing with our blog. It's like you just do it every single day and you'll get better, and people respond to that. And before you know it, you don't need to learn techniques to go to the top of Google. It'll just happen automatically, it seems.
It takes a ton of work. There's no shortcuts for that kind of thing, which is kind of like the snake oil thing of SEO. You know, that's why people would just want to pay to do it. And you're like,
that's not how it works.
Yeah. Not to crap on SEO, there's a couple of shining stars in the SEO world, but mostly
maybe there
garbage.
Are, but the truth is, at least on NetTouch, you know, NetTouch, like CSS Tricks is a very big blog, and the truth is, we don't do that much other than common sense SEO, like making your titles appropriate. We don't really do that much. I genuinely don't think it's necessary, because if the content is there, then you just jump up to the top of Google pretty soon.
So wait, you guys don't go around commenting on people's websites with like names like awesome tutorial website
and then a link back
to your site? No,
that's how I hear. No, but I have to spam those comments pretty much every single day. No, we don't do any of that at all, thankfully.
Well, it seems to be working out for you guys, because you guys put out quality week after week. It's amazing.
Thank you.
I agree. I love that site. I wanted to talk. So Chris Taylor, the dude who did our intro music again, thanks again for that, Chris. I said, you know, when he sent that in for the first time, he was like, hey, guys, I did this cool theme song for you. Also, I have this cool project called PerformerJS.org, and I mentioned it last week, and I said, let's not talk about this week, but everybody take a look at it, and then maybe we'll talk about this week. Unfortunately, I didn't get – nobody really sent in any comments about it. But, you know, if you want to check it out, it's at PerformerJS.org. What I wanted to talk about is just – its general approach to how it handles it. It's one of those libraries that's like, I want to have tabs, I want to have dialog boxes, I want to have, you know, just like UI patterns that it implements through JavaScript. And the way that it does it is by just applying classes to anything on the page. Like if you want this to have tabs, you just give it this, you know, this some kind of attribute or class or something, and it just does it. And I was like, that's interesting, and I can see how that's appealing, because it's so easy, but at the same time, it's like, you know, in order to do that with a like just set it and forget it kind of attitude, you have to have JavaScript kind of scouring every single element on the page. And if you want to do it with dynamic content, it's got to be scouring that page all the time, every single element on the page, and that makes for pretty nasty selectors and possibly poor performance. I don't know if that's true. Maybe Chris has addressed that. But Dave, did you get a chance to look at this thing or?
Yeah, now that I'm just thinking about it now, it's like, why would you call something tabs if you didn't want it to actually be tabs? And so maybe like writing the jQuery $tabs is really redundant, you know? Like I'm just thinking that through in my head here, right? Live. So okay. I apologize if that's not that through. But I do know he's putting it up on GitHub, so it'll get better. Because yeah. It's on GitHub.
The thing is, though, it really seems like with these sort of scripts, they're popping up more and more. And I think they're trying to solve some level of problem for people where, I don't know, maybe they don't know jQuery well enough or JavaScript. And maybe it does serve a purpose. But yeah, it seems like it's always this struggle with writing semantic code and then creating these little applications as quickly as possible.
Yeah. No, it's interesting.
Okay. Like, for example, if you take a look at like Knockout.js, even they work with data binding, where you're adding custom data attributes to all your elements. So if you want to listen for when something is clicked, you would do data bind click. And a lot of people don't like that. But then at the same time, you can be much, much quicker. I don't know. That is really a tough one at this point.
Yeah, even in Wufoo, you know, I'm sure some people are like, oh, yeah, I can't believe that. We still use on-click handlers for some stuff that we add dynamically just because, I don't know. First of all, the code was probably written back before, you know, where that was kind of common practice. But it's still really fast, you know. Like, I don't see a need to revisit code that's still, like, behaving really well and acting really fast, you know. I don't know. Let's skip that. We're probably gonna try to limit how much time we talk about this. We have a big hot drama section. We've always had to have a hot drama section on this show. And like last week, there just really wasn't that much. But this week, there's tons of stuff. I guess that's just how it's gonna go once in a while. So Dave, you want to kick off?
Yeah, there is so much hot drama this week. First, we got to start out with releases. This past week, we saw the release of Bootstrap 2.0. Responsive edition from the team over at Twitter, which is pretty awesome if you go look at it. And what I like the most about it is actually all the little JavaScript-y widgets around it. There's some cool like responsive image sliders and stuff like that all bundled up into it. So yeah, have you guys had a chance to play with Bootstrap 2.0?
I like it. I like that it's in less too, and not that, you know, whatever. I just I like the proliferation of vendor or of preprocessors lately. Have you checked out, Jeff?
Yeah, I looked at the beta when it was out a few weeks ago. Definitely much, much better. The funny thing about Bootstrap is there is so much hate around it. And maybe that was with version one, but you can't go on Twitter without people just going crazy over it. I remember hearing at one point that Twitter Bootstrap was number one, the most popular thing on GitHub.
And I think I said that, and you said, and I was like, that's pretty cool. And you're like, or sad. Didn't you say?
No, but I think I've kind of changed my tune on that, because if you think about it, yeah, it is kind of sad, because mostly we're just dealing with some plugins and a style sheet. And there's so much amazing stuff on GitHub. But at the same time, it's kind of natural that this would be that popular. It appeals to so many people. So, looking over the beta a few weeks ago, it looks great to me.
I think it's amazing. I think people, you can't underestimate what it takes to put together that many design patterns and have them feel really good together, have them work really well, and cover so much ground. We're doing it at SurveyMonkey. I'm working on a design pattern library that we can use for continuing development at SurveyMonkey, and it's a big, big job. Especially when you start factoring JavaScript into it and how we're going to, you know, having as much design patterns behind that, writing every single bit of JavaScript in the same kind of way with the same kind of callbacks and all that stuff. This was a monumental effort. I just think they did a good job.
Yeah, I think it's good work. I do see the comment that now it's becoming so ubiquitous, it's almost like terrorizing the internet, but it's good. And those web pages that don't have it would be so much worse without it. So I think it's doing better social good, if I were to be honest. Speaking of design patterns, if you guys didn't check it out already, Pairs, PEA.RS from Dan Cederholm dropped. It's like another design pattern library. And it's beautiful. It's awesome. It's kind of like the Dribbble Bootstrap, were I to suggest that. So did you guys check that out, Pairs?
Yeah, that's really cool. So it's just along the left. There's a little sidebar. CSS that goes with it, and it's usually really, really simple, you know. So these are design patterns, but they're not fancy design patterns. You know, there's not a lot of gradients going on here and stuff like that. It's just like, gosh, I don't know how to describe it. But there's a couple interesting things. One of the is a WordPress theme, and I tried to install it, and it didn't quite work. Did you see it, Jeff? Pairs?
Only a little bit. Like when it went crazy on Twitter, I looked over it. Yeah, I mean, it looks pretty good to me. But yeah, honestly, it's just not something I've looked over too much just yet.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's got some sweet tricks. I admire design. It's got some sweet tricks. I think I'm going to use some of them definitely for sure. Continuing on, it was a big week for Paul Irish in the HTML5 boilerplate crew. They released boilerplate 3.0. I don't know what's new in it, but I assume there's something nice, or it's just better. But they've also released yet a new version of YepNope, a new version of Modernizer. So yeah, definitely check those out.
Yeah, they're releasing a lot of stuff there. I looked at the change log for Boilerplate 3.0. Look, there's some new stuff. I heard they pulled out respond.js, which actually commented that they shouldn't do that, but they did anyway. Not that.
And not I think they also got rid of the build script, didn't they? That build script, I think, is now an external project. So I guess that's not included with the download.
That probably, from a development perspective, was probably a really big deal, which is hence the 3.0. As far as like using it, I don't think it's like super, super duper different.
I think the truth is that the bulk of people using HTML5 boilerplate weren't making use of that at all. Probably the same thing with like the testing folder. I think the truth is, like, you want to get them to use these best practices, but I think the truth is people weren't using it, for better or worse.
Honestly, how I use it is I come to the GitHub repo and look at the index.html file and copy and paste particular lines.
I'm the exact same way.
Yeah, I never, like, git clone the whole thing and start with that, you know?
Yeah, I really need, like, build script. I just need to scam some CSS. So
Right. What? And even the CSS is just normalized, right? So I use that. Okay, let's move on though. Anyway, the big super hot drama is all about it just happened in the last like day or two, is all this stuff about vendor prefixes and literally browser vendors talking about how they might just implement WebKit. And I, you know what, Dave knows more about it than me, so let's have Dave like give us the rundown of what this drama is all about.
Well, it sounds like I wasn't there, but it's what it sounds like is that the W3C were discussing about how everyone's just using WebKit. People are building for mobile and for desktop, and we're just like, oh, WebKit border radius, WebKit transition, WebKit awesome thing. And as a result, now that these other browsers are picking stuff up, they can support these properties, but no one's implemented their prefix, or no one's implemented the prefixless version. Let's say like border radius. This is the best CSS3 property ever. So no one's ever used, people used WebKit border radius and maybe Moz border radius, but certainly not O border radius, and certainly not just border radius for such a long time. But now these properties are supported by these browsers. So the browsers and the W3C, I think, we're sort of suggesting, hey, we should implement WebKit in our browser, which seems like a terrible idea. I don't know.
Is it, though? So that's what this drama is all about. Like, what if Firefox 11 or something continued to support their Moz prefixes, but also just everything would work with it? It would also read and understand WebKit prefixes. What's so awful about that? It just would make more stuff work.
I think the idea is once you go down that route, man, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, you know, that's like, what Remy Sharp is saying, I think. He's got an article here, and he's just saying it changes the minds of developers a bit.
Yeah, and it absolutely does. I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, I read that Remy article, and I agree with it completely. You just get to this point where, like, why don't we just drop all of the other browsers, you know, and just embrace WebKit? That's a tough one.
And then that's what the W3C is considering. Like, let's standardize dash WebKit. And that's where it really gets crazy. I'm like, really? You're going to standardize a name of a rendering engine? Well, at that point, then, we go back to some older conversations. Why not standardize something like dash X or dash experimental or dash, you know, well, it's weird to, if you're going to standardize something, to pick dash WebKit as the thing to standardize is weird.
Yeah.
Oh. Was it Remy's article that blamed a whole bunch of people? Was that right? He blames developers.
Who's guilty? The browsers guilty. Yeah, the working group is guilty. The evangelists are guilty. The developers are guilty. That's another thing that has weirded me out a little bit. Is this, why is this a big deal today? Do people that browse the web in Firefox, I'm sure there's lots of listeners right now that Firefox is their primary browser. Do you browse all around the internet and be like, oh, this site's all broken and stuff? If only this developer would have used Moz prefixes better. How often does that happen to you throughout the day? Is it really that big of a deal? And I don't know, on sites like CSS Tricks, I almost never write posts where I forget to put the vendor prefixes. Maybe if you looked way back in my archives, you could find some articles that only had dash WebKit in it. But I try and go back and fix those things up.
Yeah, that was my thinking as well. Are developers really exclusively using WebKit? I know we have those things where it's like, oh, this only works in WebKit, whether it's like TextStroke or something. But in general, I always had the belief that we were all really good about paying attention to all the browsers. There's like tools everywhere, whether it's prefix-free. I mean, those tools are designed to take care of every single browser. I didn't know that it was that big of an issue, to be honest, that people were exclusively using WebKit for standard properties.
I don't think it is. But that's just me. Maybe it is. Maybe it's this epidemic that I'm just not aware of, but I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I think animation and transition are probably the big ones, you know, just because it's a pain in the butt to write a 10 different animations unless you're using a preprocessor, but that's like a totally different deal. But yeah, I think
that's the thing, though. There are so many tools at this point that take care of that for you. Like if you're using a preprocessor, you can just write your own mixins. If you're using Compass, that'll just do it for you. You could use, I even built something called Prefixer that'll just do it for you. There's Prefix Free. So it's not like there aren't tools available to automate the process. There are.
Yeah.
And I get the feeling everyone's using them, but maybe not.
And even if they don't, how big of a disaster is it? You know, it's squared corners and it's stuff. I mean, maybe there's some issues with Flexbox or something where it really, really screws up the site if you're not using the proper prefixes. But it's one of those cases where it's like, you know, like Dave's got this DCSS3 bookmarklet. Most pages, you click that bookmarklet, it's not that bad. Isn't that what we're talking about here? Is like sites that just, you know, have square corners and have, you know, fallback, you know, colors instead of gradients and stuff. Is it that big of a disaster out there on the web right now?
I think one thing I've learned from these mailing lists is recognizing that the way some of these things look to just us as designers and developers, they're not nearly as simple as you think they are. You think like, oh, you know, they need to implement this. And then you find out actually that's insanely difficult and it would kill performance. So I think it's very possible to us. It may seem obvious, but these are far more complicated issues than we.
That is an absolutely true too. It's easy for me to be like, everything's fine, rah! But it's, you know, when it may not be in reality, and having little tweaks, having big snowball kind of results.
Yeah.
Truth be told, I'm probably in the everyone go WebKit camp. I'm just going to chuck that out there for controversy's sake. I'm just talking shop. I want everything to be WebKit. Whatever. I don't see what's so bad about it. Let's keep going.
Okay. Let's move into some question and answer, because I said we'd spend 15 and we spent like 20, right? So, I know. Let's throw the show out and start over.
Send in the hate mail.
I like what Jeffrey said about the specs and the, you know, building browsers and stuff being a lot more complicated than we think it is. And as I see this, and I'm sure Jeffrey sees this in comments and blog posts, they're just like, oh, I got an idea. Why don't we just do it this way or something? And it's like some total like bastardization of how the syntax of CSS goes. And yeah, you're like, you don't understand what kind of crazy stuff would happen here. And now I don't want to call anybody up, but we have a question about this. And I think it's interesting. And it's a case of where it just hasn't been thought out fully yet. And it's a question by there's two accented characters in this, and I am just like Captain America and cannot pronounce things, but Raphael Krupinski, I'm going to say. I bet that's not even too far off. He wants to say, what would you say if we could give classes to pseudo elements? So the example syntax, and he says, so section, you know, before, you know how pseudo elements are. They use the colon pseudo selector before. And then as a property in there, you know, a property being like color or border or margin or something, it says class-name. Colon, and then he gives it some string, in this case section counter. So he's applying a class name as a property in CSS. He's like, there are serious use cases for this. I feel like he came to this conclusion because he thought, you know, you can give classes to elements in your HTML, but you can't just like give a class name. Like if you want a pseudo element to have a different class name than its parent or whatever, you can't do that. So he's saying, well, why can't we just apply class name right through the CSS? What do you think?
Because you can't.
It breaks the quantum rules of CSS.
Even like the most basic idea is, okay, let's say that you have this class name of section counter that you've added to it. Well, what's to keep you from doing section counter and then stacking another pseudo element on it? So section counter before. And we know you can't stack these pseudo elements. So, yeah, I mean, these are things you just can't do it. It completely breaks the rules of CSS.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing where we don't know. I can't even speculate right now what that would do to CSS if you could all of a sudden start applying class names through it. It has consequences beyond what we can imagine, you know? It's like, I'm sure there's some awesome science fiction metaphor we could use or something, but I can't think of one right now.
Yeah, that would be like turning CSS into a DOM manipulation.
Yeah.
I guess before technically sort of does manipulate the DOM, but... like adds in something.
Yeah, and it actually doesn't because it's not part of the DOM, which is interesting.
Or it's like saying, why can't we just put HTML in CSS? It's like, you can't. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are things that sound good after thinking for 30 seconds.
So, Rafal, I would say... what you want to do there is just is extend, you know, you just want to add the properties of whatever that class name had, right? So if you're using something like SAS, you could just extend that class within that thing and it will just put those properties in there when it compiles the CSS, or just combine the selectors. Be like, whatever that class name is in your CSS that has all the right properties you want, and put a comma then and put section before after it, and then both that thing and the pseudo element will share those same properties. So there's ways to do what you want to do without kind of changing CSS fundamentally.
Yeah. Problem solved.
All right. You want to take a question, Dave?
Sure. Let's see. This one is actually a question for Jeffrey here, straight for Jeffrey from Steve Derrico, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. He wants us to ask you if you can make a theme for us for iOS because, iOS devs need good designs as well.
I guess he's asking if we can have a mobile layout for the marketplaces, and I think the idea is, yeah, that would be great, but you have to be honest with yourself when we have maybe a dozen developers and there is a stack of things that have to be done in the queue, and they're like a mile high. So for us, it always comes back to that point. How important is it for us for a marketplace like that to have a mobile optimized layout? And I think it's something we will definitely get to, but at this point in time, at least to my understanding, it's not at the top of the queue. And if you think about it, from my point of view, I can't see ever visiting ThemeForest or Code Canyon on my phone. Maybe some people are different, but that would never occur to me. Usually you visit it, you need a theme, or maybe you need some plugin that you can use in a project, and you would do that from your computer. So would people really be doing this from their phone?
Isn't he asking though? That might be the question, but the question also might be like, he is developing some kind of data-based iOS app and he wants to buy a pre-designed thing for it. So,
Oh, in that case, we actually kind of already have that. If you go to codecanyon.net, we have an apps category, and that is specifically for things like that. So it would be maybe like a little boilerplate for building a restaurant app that will be sold on the iPhone store or offered for free on the iPhone store. So yeah, we already have things like that.
Okay, there you go, Steve. That's the answer, depending, and we answered it two different ways. So.
No, I think you were right, Chris.
Okay.
Bad job.
Matt Banks asks, I'm interested in everyone's take on code editors. Kind of classic question here. And specifically, he's talking Mac. So sorry, Windows folks. We'll try to keep this short, but we're going to talk about Mac code editors for a second here. Specifically, TextMate and Sublime Text 2. What bundles packages are best to get right away to enhance, streamline the experience? So I know NetTuts had an article on Sublime Text 2 that I referenced heavily when I switched over to it. The story being that I used TextMate forever and ever and ever, and then we always thought TextMate 2 was kind of vaporware or whatever. It just would never come out. Then it did come out, and I switched to it, and I was like, I don't even think this is any different, and if anything, slightly worse for me, because I couldn't do things like right-click to add a new file in the sidebar, which I used all the time. I was like, this is crazy. It's almost a step backwards. I'm sure some people like it, but whatever. And I was like, I'm going to switch over to Sublime Text. I've heard some people are having good times with it, and I just did it one day and it just was flawless and easy, and I just never looked back. It's just better, I think. So what's up? Let's do both folks here. We'll start with Jeff. What's your code editor of choice these days? Is it one of those two or something else?
For me, I was very similar to you, Chris. I used TextMate for a long time. I think I'm one of those people that I'm irritating and that I'm always experimenting with new ones. Because you think about it, like, we spend all of our time. You spend 8 hours of your day in these editors. So it's really important that you find one that really feels right. And I think all of us were really disappointed with TextMate 2. You know, you get to that point where you're like, oh, this is going to blow us away. It's been years in the making. And then they released it and it's like, okay, maybe the code base has been rewritten. But for us, it just didn't feel that different. It just felt, like you said, Chris, if anything, just a little more difficult to use. And I think, oh, that was just really depressing. We were hoping for so much. But yeah, I mean, for me, Sublime Text 2 is far and away the best code editor I've ever used. And the coolest thing is that it is so often in development that if you're using one of the dev builds, and I think you go to like sublimetext.com/dev or something like that, but he's updating it literally every other day. So at all times you'll be working and you'll see, oh, there's a new update there. And that's a really good feeling when you feel like at all times.
Even if you don't even know what it did, it just feels good. People say that about Wufoo when we publish like an in-app notification for something in Wufoo. Like if we do something cool, most people, you know, most users of ours don't even notice or they're mostly to them. It just feels good that we're doing stuff. So that's important in an app, you know, and that's why people were so bummed about TextMate is that never happened. We never, ever, hardly ever got updates for it. And we're like, just feels weird.
Very much. People pick up on that stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah. A lot of people in the chat room saying Coda. I'm sure a lot of people out here use Vim. That's getting very popular lately. So, I don't know if we want to dwell on that too much. How about we switch over to Dave and tell us what Dave's favorite text editor is?
I use Coda, and I have been waiting for about 15 years for Coda 2 to come out.
I heard it's in development.
Actually beta users right now.
Okay. Yeah.
We're not among them, but there's a small group of testers right now.
I just sit around and wait for Coda 2. It's on my saved Twitter thing in case somebody like leaks a screenshot. I'm just sitting around waiting for Coda 2. But I've flirted with have you guys seen Chocolate App? It's like a Sublime 2. There's TextMate 2 was so underwhelming. It's just like, I'm done. But after that, man, I don't know. I've just been trying to find something I like. I've actually been switching a little bit over to Mac or to Vim just because I don't really. Yeah, it just is sometimes easier. And when you're inside of a server, like SSH'd into some strange dark server, you need to know Vim. So I've just
Vim is fantastic. For example, I switched to Sublime Text from Vim because Sublime Text has, they call it a vintage mode, but it's essentially Vim mode. And so that's really what made me switch. But yeah, before that, I was using Vim all the time. It's one of those things where I think to people who don't get it, it's just awful. You're using this 30-year-old piece of software. And the truth with Vim is that it's being updated all the time. I mean, if you go to the webpage, it was updated a few months ago. And it's just one of those things you have to be willing to dedicate a couple months of your life to getting those keyboard shortcuts into your brain. And once you do, there's no doubt that you will be faster. But at the same time, you're still in that situation where it doesn't feel right. Like you feel like, all right, it's 2012. There needs to be something much prettier for me. And at least for me, Sublime Text was that. It kind of was the best of both worlds.
Yeah. And that, yeah, I need to check out Sublime Text a little more carefully, but I like the idea of being on Vim and just that any computer you use is your environment, or you could set it up real quickly, without and for free. But yeah, I've just become so accustomed to what Coda does for me and how I've tweaked it over the last 5 years or whatever, that it works for me real fast. So I think that's what the biggest deal in any text editor is get it working for you. Don't write code by hand. Make the text editor write code for you. That's the secret. Here's a secret.
That's another big one too, is productivity, right? So if you're switching around a lot to the detriment of your productivity, maybe you should stop doing that.
That's true.
Very true. I think there's no doubt we're excited for Coda 2. I think pretty much all three of us at one point or another were using Coda. So I'm personally very excited to see what they come out with. I use Transmit 4 all the time, personally, so I'm pretty excited for that.
Nice. Transmit 4. Do I have that, or is that, do I have 3?
Mm-hmm. Transmit 3. Chris, you're advertising this? You probably have 4.
I'm looking. Yeah, I have 4. I'm there sorry. 4. Right. Yeah, 4 is awesome. That's the one that has WebDAV and all that stuff built in.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Okay, let's. You want to play us an audio one there?
Well, yeah, I'm a little worried our lady friend will talk over it, but we'll fix it in post if it doesn't work. Okay, here we go.
You are
okay.
Using an unregistered version. Oh,
I'm sorry, that's just not going to work. So let's cut that out and move on to one more question.
We're not trying to not pay for software, people. We tried to pay for it. The thing was down. Oh my god, I feel bad for Anthony Guerin too. It's a question about print style sheets. We promise we will get to that one, Anthony.
We'll get to it.
Yeah. So let's just move along to there is a new book out about HTML and CSS called, amazingly, HTML and CSS book. The website for it is HTML, literally written out, HTMLandCSSbook.com. It's kind of weird. It's there's like no author credit for it. Like, I don't know if he did that on purpose or what, but, you know, he emailed me and he asked about possibly, you know, being on the show and doing a giveaway or something. So I happen to know the guy's name is John Duckett, but I just think it's really weird that he's like not taking credit for writing this book. Is that like a marketing strategy or something?
Maybe it was a 10 author deal. And so everyone, I don't know.
Maybe that is what it is. I don't know.
Is this brand new? It looks pretty good. After a quick glance. Is it new?
It is new. And see, it's by Wiley. And the cool thing about it is Wiley books normally this is the first time Wiley has ever put out a book that's just a complete departure from the normal style they do. You see look at how like nicely designed it is. And like, it's just a complete, you know, every detail of it was kind of custom designed.
Yeah, no, it looks like the way I learned HTML was from these really gnarly O'Reilly books. I like O'Reilly, but you know, they're just these like
black and whites and
books of HTML. So, this is a really awesome way to,
he's going to send us some copies of it and, we'll be able to check it out more in detail. So maybe we'll save talking about it until we actually have seen it in our hands. The reason I brought it up is that, we're going to give some away. Yes. Which is awesome. So we're going to do it kind of like a contest, and I'm just going to like exploit you guys and be like, if you guys will please audio record a question, which if you just go to shoptalkshow.com/ask, there's a form you can fill out to ask a question. There's a link there to just go to this like MP3 recording tool and just record a question and send it in, and then we'll use it on the show or whatever. And so if you take the time to do an audio question, that automatically will enter you to win this book, which even if you know HTML really well, it looks so nice that you want it. Actually, it looks kind of like bulletproof CSS, or how like beautiful and like project walkthrough-y it looks. We'll see.
Yeah.
It looks great.
Yeah, I want to get my hands on it and read it.
Yeah, we're going to get copies.
You would think they would have done this by now, you know, with I hear the book industry is just going down and down every single year. They have to be doing this stuff. That's why it's always depressing. A new CSS book comes out and it's black and white and it looks as boring as it could possibly get. And this stuff is really fun if they would design it the right way. So hopefully this is the first of many.
I've thought about buying that HTML for babies or whatever, the CSS for babies book.
I totally have that. I have
it. Just for an entertaining read. But
I was thinking of publishing a scathing critical review of it. It's like every single like selector, there's a problem with every single part of it. And I still think it's funny. It's like, if people haven't seen it, it's like big cardboard, thick pages. It's only like 10 pages long. And it has like selectors and properties and values, you know, just like CSS, but in like huge font and fancy children like colors and stuff. It's really funny. It's like you could literally sit there and read to your kid and be like, you know, navigation, open bracket, background color red or whatever. It's great, but like everything is like, I would never write a selector like that. I'd be like, oh, how is that not vendor prefixed? Ah. There's like, you could critique every selector in it. Anyway, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So if you want to win the HTML and CSS book, just record an audio question and send it in, and you'll win possibly. We'll pick one winner a week for a couple weeks in a row. All right, let's move on to questions, though.
All right, here's one from Imran Ashraf. I think I got it. This is for Jeffrey. Hey, Jeffrey, how many hours a day do you spend on learning web development? You seem to know it all. How do you take it in? What's your secret?
There is no secret. There is no secret. It's very nice of him to say, but the truth is, and I think Chris, you could probably relate. Like when we run these big blogs, people are very nice. And the truth is, I sort of feel like a hack. I feel like every night I'm desperately trying to keep up with everyone else. I don't know. It's really hard. I think it's like this kind of stair step effect where if you're at the bottom, you know, some people look like they're amazing. And then once you get to that level, you realize just how high the stairs go. You know, for example, like you had Paul Irish on the show. That guy is so ridiculously smart to the point that it's irritating. You know how some people are that way? you know, like they're so smart that you're almost mad at them for being that way. I will prepare a presentation, and by the time it's done, he will have traveled around the world and done five or something. So I think it really just depends on where you are in your learning phase. And I don't know if you'll ever get to that point where you classify yourself as a master. I just don't think it can ever happen. I was listening to this podcast not too long ago called Hansel Minutes, and they had what's his name, John Skeet. And for those unfamiliar, John Skeet is he works for Google, and he's like one of the top guys on Stack Overflow. And he has the same thing where he feels like, and by the way, I'm not comparing myself to him in any way, shape, or form, but he has that same thing where he always feels like he's not quite to that level that his coworkers are. And I even researched this at one point, and it's called Dunning-Kruger disease. I wrote about it on NetTuts. And it's just basically this idea that the people who truthfully don't really know what they're doing somehow seem to be far more confident of their skills than the people who do. And it seems like when you really know what you're doing, you question yourself so much more. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I spend a few hours a day like everyone else, but maybe because NetTuts allows me to be in the spotlight a little bit more, it stands out more, but I'm just like everyone else. I'm reading every single night trying to keep up with the rest of you.
I have a question. Maybe this is a trade secret, but how does NetTuts work? Is there like just a queue of things like you guys have you want to write about and you just cherry pick the ones you're most interested in, or do you just get assigned like, surprise, you're learning Node this week, write it? Or how does that
Truth is, we at NetTuts, I'm always cramming to find writers. And I think you think because NetTuts has, you know, we have like millions of visitors a month, we have 100,000 subscribers, and you would think it would be really easy to find authors. And the truth is, I struggle with it every single week. And I think you get into that situation where people think, oh, I'm not even going to bother. I'll write an article and there's no chance it'll be a waste of my time. And the truth is, that's not the case at all. If you can write well and you know what you're talking about, you absolutely can have an article in NetTouch or even a magazine. A lot of it just comes down to being able to deliver. And most people cannot do that. Reliability is so, so important. I think that's maybe like in our field, reliability is more important than anything. You can be an amazing developer, but if you simply just don't come through and you aren't as reliable, I would much rather have the person that may not be as smart as you, but will actually get the job done. So the way with NetTuts works is I have a list of things that I really want to post on the site, things that I'm personally very, very curious about. So it's a nice thing for me because whatever I want to learn, I can say, hey, I'll pay somebody if they'll write an article for this, and I kind of get a lot done there. But mostly I just keep this list and I have some staff authors, and then I'm always contacting people to contribute. So yeah, there's no specific system to it. It's just doing your best to find people to write the content for us.
Nice. So we'll put a link to them. I'm sure there, you know, maybe there's some people in this audience who didn't know that, and we'll, you know, get a hold of Jeffrey. We'll put some links in the show notes about if you feel like writing an article and making some bucks doing it. If you're good, Jeffrey will pay you.
I've actually been assured that our listener demographic is at least 10% smarter than all other listening demographics.
There you go. It. You know it.
It's a fact. I did research.
So Imran wanted to know about how Jeffrey gets it all done, right? And when I read that question, I thought of a few things. I have a little website called quotesondesign.com, which is just an archive for me of quotes that I found interesting or inspiring or whatever. There's a 1,000 quotes there. So one of them is by Philip Glass, who's like a composer. He does that kind of the way people describe him is he like does the same thing over and over and over at the end, changes it once or something. I don't know. That might be a mischaracterization. But anyway, he's a composer kind of guy. He's got a quote I put on here that says, "You get up early in the morning and you work all day. That's the only secret." So that's
so true.
Yeah. And there's one more I got here from Herb Kelleher. I'm not sure who Herb is. That's embarrassing. And he's got another quote that says, "We have a strategic plan. It's called doing things." So it's just one of those things. Like there's not a lot of secret. I get this question sometimes. How do you get it all done? And you're like, I don't know. You just do it. You press the keys on your keyboard and stuff. I don't
know. And I think a lot of it comes down to in liking the stuff you're doing. I mean, some of this stuff, I think really we would probably do it for free if we had other jobs. And I think that's a big deal. That you actually have to enjoy what you're doing so that you're willing to, you know, watch a movie and write or work on a project and it doesn't really feel like work to you. That's really important.
I'd say that's a big deal. Like if you come home at the end of the night or whatever or just at any point in the day, if you like look at your couch and the TV and you're like, "Oh, I'm tired. What am I going to do right now? Should I flip that thing on?" Or and then you look over your laptop and you're like, "Ugh, I definitely don't want to crack that thing open." Usually when I'm in that position, I'm like, "Ooh, laptop." You know? So that's
good. Ooh, laptop. Yeah. That's a soundbite. That's for sure. Ooh, that's gonna be my new ringtone for you.
Because I like it. It's fun. I want to answer some emails and see what the community is talking about and stuff. It's probably a little unhealthy at some point because I'm sure all of us struggle with a little bit of internet addiction.
No, it's absolutely unhealthy when you're in bed with a laptop on your lap. Yeah. But it's good.
Well, you do get stuff done.
No, right, it's so bad for me to the point that I've even researched these apps because I'm a Mac user. And if people who work at night will know that the lowest brightness setting on the Mac is still not very low at all. So you can research these apps that'll take it down to like 2% brightness just so it doesn't kill your eyes at night. Like you said, that's probably a very bad sign, but it definitely helps.
No, that'd be nice. That'd be nice.
All right, well, Jeff, you want to hit us up with another question, Jeffy? Boom, boom.
With me?
I got this one. So this will be the last one. And I'm going to do a question from Brian Feeney. It's about how you test Internet Explorer. This will be our last one, and then we're going to wrap it up. Internet Explorer. What do you use to test that thing without partitions or a separate PC? I assume he's a Mac user.
Browser stack.
And secondly, how much thought do you give to IE when you're building your style sheet? So you're saying browser stack. I love browser stack.
Browser stack is one of the best things that's ever come to a web designer in the last year. It's incredible. For those unfamiliar, it's browserstack.com. And the way it works is you sign up. I think you get a free hour of testing by default. But you can pretty much view a design in any single browser. And at this point, I know they recently added you can test on like the Windows version of Opera or the Mac version of Opera or Chrome. And so you can easily test, see how is my site looking in IE7 or IE8. And you don't have to worry about using these virtual machines anymore, especially if you're a Mac user. It's a godsend at this point. What do you use, Chris?
Browser Stack is rad. And another cool feature of Browser Stack is, so I just wrote an article today about preprocessors and why at the top of it I said, everybody's got to be working locally. That's a big deal, right? If you're not developing locally, we should have a talk or whatever, but I don't want to harp on you too bad. Anyway, we pretty much work on every single one of our projects locally. How can Browser Stack, which is it's literally a website, and it loads up these other browsers in I think it's Java or something, a window. If you're working locally, how can it see your local stuff? It would really have to be a website on the internet for that to work, right? And yes, we'll grab a site off the internet, but one of the most amazing innovations, I think, in Browser Stack is that you can set up this little tunnel, and it takes like 2 seconds. You click on this little thing, you pop it up, and you say, where's your local thing hosted? And you just put in what your local domain is. It could be an IP, or it could be your host file, could point to something, whatever. You tell it what port's on, and you hit OK. And then it does some kind of behind the scenes magic, and you can look at your local development environment in Browser Stack in these other browsers, and that's what I use it for primarily. I think that's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing we do at Parabell is we bought like a $200 laptop, just like went into Office Depot and found the cheapest one, and bought that, crack it open, install like IE Tester or something similar on it. And then we'll use, you know, we'll keep it local, but we'll use something like showoff.io, which is like basically it's a proxy or a tunneler to your computer, but totally awesome. And yeah, so, and you can use it for free for like 5 minutes at a time. So then you're testing it on an actual Windows machine there. So the Browser Stack might be the way forward.
That's cool. I would see some people are going to be like, IE tester, those aren't real IEs. That's definitely going to happen. I think there are some cases where they're true. I think 99% of the time they're fine, and you're trying to fix some simple little problem, and you know what I mean. So the fact that it's not 100% exactly perfect isn't that big of a deal. Buying the Windows machine is fine, somebody that's anti-IE tester, what they would do instead is they would have a VM, which is like VMware Fusion or whatever. And I'm sorry, we always talk about Mac stuff, but I'm sure Windows has things to run VMs too. I use actually VirtualBox, which is totally free and almost just as good as these paid ones like VMware Fusion or Parallels. VirtualBox, totally free. And I have a copy of Windows. And what they would do is just like replicate the VM a bunch of times and like install like XP and then leave IE6 on it, which is what it comes with or whatever. And then like clone that and upgrade to IE7 and then clone that and upgrade to IE8 and then like maybe get a Windows 7 install that has 8 on it and then clone that and get 9. So they have all these different VMs that they could boot up. Even in parallel if they wanted to, and like use the absolute native version of it. And that's fine too. It's a little faster than Browser Stack, honestly, because Browser Stack has to go like, you know, has to use two internet connections kind of. So you get a little bit of speed that way. Although that speed might be midgetated by the fact that you're running two operating systems, so you get some slowdown that way.
That's what I did originally. I agree with you though. The truth is, for me, Browser Stack works in pretty much 99% of the situations. Maybe if you're working on these massive, massive projects, yeah, you want to do that. But for small to medium-sized projects, Browser Stack is perfect. It works really well. Highly recommend.
There's another one, too. If I can dig it up, I'll put it in the show notes, too. But yeah, they don't pay us or anything. I'm literally a paying customer of Browser Stack because I just think it's so useful. And I should talk too, because I keep getting emails. My site CSS Tricks a little screwed up in IE8 at the moment, and I really got to fix it. And I'm gonna hopefully I'll do that later today. Well, I keep saying that though, but I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna open up my local WordPress where I have an exact clone of CSS Tricks and open up Browser Stack and get my local tunnel going and fix up the things and then push up the changes. Over FTP, which is a whole nother talk someday, because I'm still annoyed with my FTP workflow. That's all the questions this week. We were hoping to get through a few more, but it's going on an hour already. We got to thank Jeff Way for coming on. We're going to list all. Jeff, how do people follow you, your work, all that stuff?
Cool. So you can visit net.touchplus.com. That is the blog I manage, and I also write there quite a bit. You can go to the marketplaces. So you could go to themeforest.net or codecanyon.net, or you can say hi on Twitter at Jeffrey_Way, or my website, jeffrey-way.com. So yeah, lots of ways.
Okay. Thanks so much for being on. This was a really good one. Jeff's in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which has the world's fastest internet. Interesting fact about...
And I still manage to get pissed off at it.
Not fast enough.
It'll never be fast enough for us.
Yeah. Great life lesson. All right. We need some outro music or something.
But you've been listening to Shop Talk, a podcast about web design development stuff. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week. We'll have another live show, and we actually may have some bonus content for you. So stay tuned for that. And yeah, Chris, sign us off.
ChopTalkShow.com.